Today is Shabbat, 18th of February. I'm Nick Aronson. I'm a student here at the Hebrew University. And today we'll be talking about Passover, which might seem kind of strange, a little early. But in the parasha, the weekly reading, we read it 2-3 weeks ago, so I thought it's still appropriate, and it's the feast that's coming up. Although I don't want to talk about the festival and the content of it. I want to talk about the word Passover. Now, the word Passover as a verb occurs several times in the Bible and three times in Exodus 12 in the discussion about Passover itself. And I would like to read those three passages before we continue talking about this word. The first is in Exodus 12. Verse 13. So Exodus 12, verse 13. Here it says, so first God gives the what they have to do with the blood, and then it says, "The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live. When I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague shall destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." Now, if any one of you has a different translation for "and I will pass over you," could you please let me know? I don't know if there are any other translations than that. There shouldn't be any other translations. Well, there should be other translations, but I don't think there are any other translations. So here this verb occurs, "I will pass over you." But this verb isn't used very much in the Bible. So actually, what we'll see is that this translation of Passover can be contested. There are other translations, although not in our modern English Bibles. Let's go to the next occurrence. It's in verse 23. Almost the same. Here it says, "For the Lord will pass through to strike down the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over that door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you down." Again, he will pass over. And then the last occurrence is in verse 26. Verse 27. Well, I'll read from verse 26. "And when your children ask you, 'What do you mean by this observance?' you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, for he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he struck down the Egyptians but spared our houses, and the people bowed down and worshipped him.'" Now, as I said, all the English translations translate this verb, Pasach, from which is the word Pesach. Maybe you've heard that word in Hebrew. They all translate it as to pass over. But I looked at some of the old and ancient translations to see what they would do with this verb. Now, there is an Aramaic translation, probably, I don't know exactly when, but let's say 4th century AD. The translation is Onkelos, and he translates this word with to have mercy or to have compassion. So he would translate, "And the Lord had compassion over the Israelites," or over the door. Now, another translation, another Aramaic Targum, translates or always gives the word Pasach, but apparently he wanted to add what he thought it meant, and he always adds "to protect." So he says, Pasach, and I don't know if he knew what it meant, but then he gives the verb "to protect." So here he would translate it as, "And God protected the door of the house." Now, we'll get later to those interpretations. I also looked at the Septuagint. The Septuagint was translated, the Torah, in the 3rd century B.C., and they translate this verb with "to cover" or "to shelter." So God shelters the house of the Israelites, or covers the house of the Israelites. So it's a very interesting thing to see that none of these ancient translations reads here to pass over. So you wonder, how did we get to such a unified translation of this verb? Now we have to go back to the 11th century AD, and in that century lived a Jew called Rashi, a rabbi, and he wrote a commentary on the Torah that had a huge influence on all the commentaries following him, Jewish commentaries, but apparently also Christian commentaries. And he said this about this verb. He said, every time you find the verb pasach, it has the idea of to skip, ledalek in Hebrew. So he said, God skipped from the houses of the Israelites to those of the Egyptians. And he explains it. He says, the houses of the Egyptians and the Israelites were intermingled, and God skips from the one to the other. Okay. Now, the proof that he gives for this translation is found in 1 Kings 18, verse 21. So let's go to that verse. Chapter 18, verse 21. 1 Kings 18, verse 21. This is the story of Elijah on Mount Carmel, and he gathers everyone together, and he wants this big playoff between Baal and the Lord. And this is what he says to the Israelites before everything is going to happen. He says, or Elijah then came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping with two different opinions? Now, Rashi would say, here you have to read, how long will you go skipping between those two different opinions?
In the Jewish translation here, it says hopping between two.
Hopping. Perfect. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Mine says
wait. I like that because it's wrong. But it's very nice that it does it, because it shows what a unified idea we have about this one verb, bisach. Because what people do, and I'll have to talk a little bit about how people approach words that occur not too many times in the Bible, but I'll get to that in a little bit. But this is what is done for this one verb. People have an idea of what it means, and it's related to a lame person. A lame person in Hebrew is called a piser. Maybe I should write a few words on it. I'll write it in Latin letters. So a lame person is called a piser. The verb that we are talking about is pasach. And for those who don't know Hebrew, the vowels are, in this case, less important. What you see in the text is always the consonants. So here you see that it is about the same verb. Pisach and pasach are related verbs. So we're talking about this, and this is the lame person. So what Rashi said is, what Rashi apparently thought is, that the movement of a lame person, which is hopping or limping, that is what is done. But he didn't say limping. You can't say that God was limping from one house to another. He has this idea that a lame person hops. Where does he get that from? He doesn't say it specifically, but only one time in the Bible there's a clear connection between jumping and a lame person. Maybe I should. I'll get to that in a little bit. First, I want to say something about this occurrence here in 1 Kings 18. So this is that fight between the Lord and Baal, and this is what is said again. How long will you go? I'll use the translation hopping. How long will you go hopping with two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Now, there is an opposition of two ideas here. Either you hop between two different opinions, or you go and follow after one. And that follow after one is follow straight after him. There are other occurrences of this following after, which clearly indicate you go in a straight line. This is what you do. You don't swerve, you follow one person. Now the opposite is you hop. See, there you already see that hopping doesn't really work. You have this, the walk of a lame person. You stumble, you limp from one to the other. That is the idea here in 1 Kings. You're not sure. You want to follow the Lord. You want to follow Baal. And so you don't go straight after someone. You waver. The way a lame person would go. So here it's used as a metaphor. Okay. Now, as I indicated already, there is a little bit of a problem, and the problem is that you can't say that God was going as a lame person. Where does Rashi get this idea from then, that a lame person jumps? It's from Isaiah 35 verse 3-6. And again, he didn't mention this specifically that he got it from here, but he uses the verb that is used in this passage to explain the verb pisel or pasah, and that's why I would like to look at this verse. Here it says, "Strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful, who are of a fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you." Oh, I'm reading from verse 4. Okay, verse 5. "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer." Hear the lame leap. So what Rashi thought apparently is, okay, the lame leap. The problem is, this is about the Messianic kingdom. The blind will see. The lame will leap. It's not the normal way of a lame person. So here, he made a little bit of a jump, saw those two in one context, apparently thought, okay, so a lame person jumps, so every time I read the word Pesach, I have to read to skip or to jump. So that's what he did throughout all these passages, and that's why he read in Exodus 12, "And God skipped from the house of the Israelites to the house of the Egyptians." But actually there is not really any strong evidence for that. And that you would actually say that this is clear evidence here in Isaiah that the lame does not jump. And therefore, this verb, you can't use it for that context in Exodus 12. You can't say that God jumped from the one house to the other. Now that's a problem. Another problem for Rashi was Exodus 12 verse 23 and the explanation of that. Let's read that again. Here it says, "For the Lord will pass through to strike down the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over that door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your house to strike you down." Now there are two characters here in this verse, and they seem to be a little blended, but in the end of the verse they are separated. There's the Lord and there's the destroyer. So apparently God sent a destroyer throughout Egypt to kill all the firstborns. But then he does something over the door that does not allow the destroyer to enter that house. Now the problem is, if you say, "And the Lord will skip over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your house," you have a little bit of a problem. I mean, you can still blend it. You could say, well, the Lord and the destroyer are one. But it could very well be that there are two different ideas. For example, if we take one of those interpretations that we read earlier from the Aramaic Targums, God had mercy over the house of the Israelites and did not let the destroyer come into their house. It's a possibility, and that's how the ancients read it till about Rashi's time. So that's a possibility, and that was a little bit of a difficulty for Rashi. Now you wonder then, what is the solution? How should we read it? What we have to do is we have to look at all the occurrences of this verb pesach and see what it might mean. So we look at other contexts and we see, okay, there is apparently the way the lame person goes, but you can't fit that in this context here. You can't say, and God hobbled over the door of the Israelites to the door of the Egyptians. You can't say that. So we'll look at another context, and there is one other context in which the verb pasach is used in a very interesting way, which is not the movement of a lame person. It's in Isaiah 31 verse 5. And this is a passage about God protecting Jerusalem. And this is what it says: like birds hovering overhead, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will spare and rescue it. Now four verbs are given, and in the English it is of course not clear.
It says Passover.
It says Passover? Mm-hmm. What translation do you have?
New NIV.
What is this? Yes,
we.
NIV as well.
It translates to Passover? Very interesting.
And Amplified.
So you see that all these other texts have a huge bearing on the interpretation of this verse. And that is one of the problematic ways when you have a verb that you don't really know what it is, but you have some other context. What you start to do is you take all the meanings from the other context and just push it in here. Even if there's no indication in the context, what you do is you just cram it in there, and that's the meaning of it. God passes over. But if you look at all these verbs, you see that they are used in a parallelism. And the parallels explain each other. So you have to protect and deliver, to and to rescue.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I would, if we look at the Hebrew verbs, I would say to protect. Oh yeah, to protect and deliver, that is correct.
Or to shield.
And then the third word is our pasach, and then to rescue. So to deliver and to rescue are the same, the second and the fourth. The first and the third are also the same. It is to protect and pasach. So apparently, pasach is used with the meaning to protect. God protects. So this is quite a clear instance in which you can see through that parallelism what the meaning of pasach is. Again, we don't take the meanings that we see in other contexts and push it in here. We mark that one word that we don't know with an X, and we look at the context and think, okay, what does it mean here? And then we see, well, it needs to indicate that God protects. Now we go back to our verse in Exodus. Let's go to Exodus 12, verse 23.
Parallels are a very common and beautiful thing in Hebrew language.
Yes.
Preferable.
Yeah, this is a very common way to deal with or finding meanings of words, using parallelism to establish, now, what is the, in linguistics they call it the semantic field. What does it not specifically mean, but what is the field of meaning? And here the field of meaning is protection. And we go again to Exodus 12 verse 23, for example, and then we read, "For the Lord will pass through to strike down the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will protect that door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your house to strike you down." So here we have God sending his plague, the destroyer, but seeing the blood on the doorpost, he protects that house so that the destroyer, the plague that he sent, will not enter that house. Now, I would like to say, before I continue with this idea, I would like to say a few things about verbs. And one of them is that sometimes one word can have two meanings, two completely separate meanings, or the two meanings could be related. And the question is here, are these two meanings, to protect and to pass over, related, or are they completely separate and we should see them as separate? Now, even in English, we have this problem. For example, the word ear, ear of a head or ear of a corn. Now, are those two related or aren't they related? Well, if you see where it comes from, then even in Old English you see already a distinction. Ear from a head was written with an E in the end, E-A-R-E, while ear of corn was a different ear. So already in Old English you see a difference, and they stem from two different Latin words. So they are clearly two different words, but through history became similar. And now even native speakers could think that ear of a corn is related to ear of a head. And I don't know how you would explain it, but maybe with modern logic you try to explain, well, you know, ear of a head is high up on your head, and therefore ear of a corn is like that too. I don't know. Sounds kind of stupid. Or the shape of it. But what you also can have is that two words look exactly the same, they have different meanings, but they are still connected. For example, maybe some of you have heard that joke, what is the national bird of Israel? And it's the crane. And everyone points out the building cranes here.
It's the hoopoe.
It's the hoopoe.
I know, but they make the joke because Israel is building so much that they make a joke. It's the crane. But actually, those two words are connected. The people gave the name crane to that mechanical device because it looks like the bird. So in this case, the two verbs that look the same, there is a connection. One is given the name because it looks like the bird. So the words that are given to these two options are homonymy and polysemy. Those are difficult words. Homonymy means the two words look the same, but they're not connected, like the ear. Polysemy is two words, different meanings, but there is this connection. For example, with our crane, there is the metaphor. One is called a crane because of the bird. Okay, now maybe it's good to look at some biblical examples before we go. We come back to our Pesach. If you start learning Hebrew, one of the first words you learn is the word for foot, which is regel. Now, throughout the Bible, regel means foot, except for three occurrences, or I don't know exactly how many occurrences, but one of them occurs in the parasha, the reading for this week, in Exodus 23, verse 14. I would like to go to that one. Now, if it is correct, then all your translations will say, three times in the year you shall hold a festival for me. And here the word is regel. So what you don't do is, you look at all the other meanings of regel and you say foot, and therefore you put it also in here. No, you mark it with an X, and you say, now what could this word mean? It looks like it is foot, but it doesn't seem to fit the context. So you mark it and you think, what could it mean? And there are other places, for example, Bileam. I don't know, do you call him Bileam or Balaam? Bileam?
Balaam?
Balaam. Okay, Balaam. When Balaam beats his donkeys, he beats his donkey three times, and the word that is used is regel. So it's very clear that regel means time, but it also means foot. Now the question is, are time and foot connected? And in our modern logic, we could, you know, we could figure something out, especially in this context. We could say, well, these three festivals, apparently, it says that the people have to appear before the Lord, so they are pilgrim festivals, you know. So maybe we could translate here, three pilgrim festivals you have to celebrate before the Lord. And that's what people have done. In some English translations, you will see pilgrim festivals. And I don't know if it's related to the word regel, or if it's related to the context that follows. But that's the problem with modern logic. We think that we know what the ancient mind is, but often the ancient mind thinks in different ways. Sometimes it connects two words that we have no idea why they connected those two words, and we will never know why they connected those two words. In other instances, we can, once we realize that they are connected, we can see that, okay, yeah, we can understand that connection. But often our modern logic doesn't give the right answer. So again, what we do is we mark with an X and we see what should it mean in this context. Now the question still is time and food, are the two related? So what you do, what you have to do in linguistics is find a precedent. And a precedent is you find another word that has those two meanings, both food and time. If so, you know that the ancient mind apparently connected these two words. And there is another word for that means both time and food. I won't go into it. I'll skip the example. I'll just mention it. The word pa'am. Modern Hebrew, it even means time. But in the Bible, it also means foot. There are some clear examples. For example, in Song of Songs, it says, how beautiful are your pa'am in your sandals. So that's very clear. Well, it must be foot. It can't be anything else. And there are some other very clear examples. So this is an example of polysemy. Two words that are have different meanings, but that are connected in the ancient mind. Now, an example of homonymy is the word tzav. Tzav is a type of lizard. It also is a type of a wagon. Now, people have thought, okay, a type of lizard, maybe it's a turtle, and then maybe you have this wagon that has a bubble on it. So that's the way we connect them. But here in this case, they're completely separate. It just happened that there is a word for lizard that is also a word for wagon. There's no connection whatsoever between them. A more interesting one, and then I'll stop my diatribe about Mania and Polysem, and we'll go back to Pesach. An interesting one is Zaken. Zaken is an old man. All right, that. Zaken is an old man, and then you have a word for beard, and the word for beard is zakan. Now, use that with your modern logic. Modern logic says, zakan, an old man has a beard. I mean, it's very obvious. Every biblical Hebrew dictionary that you'll open up connects these two. The problem is, it's modern logic. Because for ancient Semites, not just for Hebrews, it's also in Arabic, in Old Arabic. The beard is not the symbol for old age. The beard is a symbol for maturity and masculinity. And therefore, it's a wrong connection. And in the Bible, you'll never find a connection between beard and old person. What you find is a gray beard and the old person. But the word for gray beard is that's different. So we have connected them, but they aren't together in both in Hebrew, in Arabic, but also in Akkadian. I have a nice example from Akkadian that shows that the beard is a sign for masculinity instead of for being old. There was a king of Assyria called Shamshi Adad. He wrote a letter to his son, the viceroy who he left in charge of a kingdom of Mari, a city. In this letter, the father expresses anger that over his son's lack of maturity, because the son apparently failed to take over the administrative and military responsibilities of this king. So this is what he writes to his son. Are you still a child, not a man? Is there no hair on your cheek? That's a nice example that a beard is a sign for masculinity or for the prime of age, not for an old person. And an old person, with the word zaken, is a really old person. It's not just an older person. So here, even though the two look very alike, Zakan and Zakan, they are not connected. They just happen to be the same word. Now let's go back to our word Pasach. The question is, are these two connected? On the one hand, we have Pasach, the way a lame person goes. On the other hand, apparently, we have Pasach, protecting. Now, are those two connected, or aren't they? The only way to connect them is if you have a precedent. There is no precedent. They're just... there's no other word that has the way a lame person goes and to protect. So therefore, these two words just happen to be the same. And therefore it is dangerous to use one verb to explain the other. They're completely different, and therefore this is how we have to read the Exodus story. So what you find in a dictionary should be the verb Pasach number one, which means the way a lame person goes, and you give the example, for example, of 1 Kings 18 verse 21, one of Baal and the Lord, and you have Pasach number two, to protect, completely different ones. Now, that might have been a little theoretical, but the conclusion is, we're not calling the festival then the festival of Passover, we call it the festival of divine protection. That is what you celebrate. You don't celebrate the fact that God passed from one house to the other. You celebrate that God protected your son. Now, this idea might sound kind of strange, that God sent a destroyer and then he protects a little group from that destroyer. So I was looking for examples in the Bible where you see something similar. One of the examples is in 2 Samuel 24, where David has sinned and an angel is sent through the land to destroy. Let's read it. 2 Samuel 24. Verse 15. So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel from that morning until the appointed time. And 70,000 of the people died from Dan to Beersheba. But when the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented concerning the evil and said to the angel who was bringing destruction among the people, "It is enough. Now stay your hand." Now it's not an exact parallel, but it shows God sending his destroyer out into the land. But then when it gets to a certain point, he protects.
The same word for angel destruction is in Exodus.
Yes, it's the same word. It's the angel of destruction is called the Mashchit in Exodus and here too. Okay, so these are examples that I got from the professor that explained this whole issue with Pasach. But I thought, now let's continue looking at examples. And I thought about the book of Revelation, because the book of Revelation is full of Exodus language. And I thought, can we see a connection between Pesach and the book of Revelation? So I read the whole book, and I marked everything that in my eyes had a connection with Pesach. And the first is Jesus as the Lamb. He's continuously depicted as the Lamb who was slain. In the beginning, it also says that we are freed by His blood. Well, this idea of redemption by blood seems to have this connection with Pesach. This last plague, the blood that protected over your house, and now you're set free and you go towards the promised land. So already from the start in the book of Revelation, there seems to be this connection with Pesach. Now, when we go to Revelation 7, Revelation 7, verse 3. Here are the angels described that are going to bring the plague. And in verse 3, God says, "Do not damage the earth or the seas or the sea or the trees until we have marked the servants of our God with a seal on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000, sealed out of every tribe of the people of Israel. Now here it seems to indicate, which you see later in the book, that the ones with the seal are the ones that are the protected ones. So here again, God is going to send plagues, but before that, he marks his people and protects them. Now, also later in the book, you'll read more about the plagues. You have a plague that water turns into blood. You have a plague of darkness. You have locusts. Ah, here, this is a good one to read. Revelation 9, verse 3. It says, "Then from the smoke came locusts, and on the earth, and they were given authority, like the authority of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to damage the grass of the earth, or any green growth, or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads." So again, here you see that among the plagues, there was a small group that was protected. And here it's done by a mark on the forehead. Earlier it was a mark on the front of the house, the entrance of the house. And then in Revelation 15, there's another connection. Those who conquered the beast sing the song of Moses and of the Lamb. So you have a lot of language about the Exodus and about Pesach in the book of Revelations. So to go back to Exodus 12 and the meaning of Pesach. So what we read is, God sends the destroyer through Egypt, but those who have marked their house with this blood, God will protect that house against the destroyer that might come in. So the festival is not the festival of Passover, it's the festival of God's divine protection. Now, I haven't thought through many of the implications of this. I know it's a difference that when you read the text, this is one of the conclusions you arrive at. But maybe there are other conclusions that I haven't seen. So this is all I wanted to say. If there's any input, any questions.
I was going to ask earlier when we went to the Revelations about linking to the New Testament of Jesus, and where in the New Testament it talks about the blood covering and protection in that sense. Is there, and you could look at the Greek, is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. I didn't do it. I thought of events, and therefore I arrived at the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. But that's a good question. So that's a good idea. Because I do think that if this is the translation that you see in, for example, the Targumim, then that is likely also the idea that the New Testament readers understood, and also from the Septuagint. So it's very likely that they used ideas related to that also in the New Testament books. It's a good question.
Mark also seems to like Exodus a lot too.
Uh-huh.
So you would like the Revelation.
Yeah. Any question about this? Okay.
It does bring, I mean, I often combine that the destroyer is the only actor in the picture, that God tells him to just, you know, like we said, jump over those houses because of that blood. But actually the blood is only a sign, and it's God himself who is like standing in front of those houses. And that's a much more intimate, active role of protection, it seems like, than I previously thought of. So.
Yes, I thought about the difference, and I didn't want to say this because I want to show that the difference is as big as possible. Either you read skipping over, or it is divine protection. But then when I thought about it, I thought, well, they're awfully close. I mean, God skips over the house, or God protects the house. It's the same event. They're not killed. But Tren is right that there is a much more active role in God's protection. And who knows? I haven't looked at the other texts in the New Testament, for example. Who knows? This might give other ideas that help us read other texts better. But as I said, I don't know. But what you see is God's active involvement in protection.
I know that you didn't get into this week, but you brought up 2 Samuel 24, and that there was the Lord sending destruction on his own people.
Uh-huh.
The text doesn't seem to resolve itself with the census. It seems to be something with this numbering of people that God is ticked off.
Mm-hmm.
Did you spend a lot of time in that chapter to offer some sort of answer to that?
No. I focus solely on this aspect of destruction and protection. So,
isn't it because you're asking why the number? Isn't it because God promised David that he would have too many to count, and then David's trying to count
them? But I mean, the chapter itself doesn't
say.
For sure, we have to look. Yeah.
Yeah, I can continue with that.
Is it linked to pride? He had the general also warns David not to go there, so the general must have George Joe knows that this is what he shouldn't do as well. So there seems to understand that there as well.
It's interesting because when God says it is enough, now stay your hand in this passage, it says, and the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arona the Jebusite, and God, a name, came that day to David and said to him, go raise up an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of the Jebusite. And isn't that the same threshing floor that Solomon later builds the temple on?
Yeah. These kings said that, right? That was
Chronicles. Chronicles, yes. That's well, no, Chronicles mentions Moriah. Does he also mention Arona?
Don't
remember.
Okay.
That's kind
of
interesting as well.
That's just interesting on that point that two of David's major mistakes, God turns into blessing. His sin with Bathsheba and King Uriah, Solomon is a result of that, and Solomon becomes king and builds a temple, and then the space where the angel stops, and then the temple is built. So God can take our mistakes and make them into blessings.
Okay. So that's it for today.
Thank you.